Hey, thanks very much, Shireen. Good morning, everyone. I'm delighted to be chairing this first panel entitled The Power of Aesthetics. We have three papers to begin with, and we're going to have each paper in turn. Each paper giver has around 20 minutes, I think we've agreed, to present, and then hopefully there'll be some time for discussion afterwards. So I'd like to first of all introduce Partha Mitter from Sussex/Oxford, who is going to be presenting a paper entitled Power and Authority in Cultural Exchanges, a Revisionist Approach. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Nick. It's such a rich wide-ranging array of papers, but mine is going to be simply trying to open up the discussion. It's a shortened version of something I wrote a little while ago. It can come out. But one of the things I've been very interested in, globalization, and what does it mean, and whether the power relations remain the same or are they upset, and how do we cross borders, as it were, cultural. Okay, let me start, and I won't be more than 20 minutes, I promise. If I croak, do forgive me. Debates on the interface between East and West and the problematic nature of cultural exchanges have assumed a fresh urgency today because of the increasing globalization of culture. Our period has witnessed an unprecedented proliferation in transcultural conversation made possible by the late 20th century revolution in communication technology, which we all know about. Comparable in many ways to the spread of multinational capital, the world art market has reached enormous proportions. Monster art auctions and biennales now readily welcome artists from outside Europe and America. Now, while the inclusion of artists from regions that were previously seen to be peripheries certainly is commendable, but there is a disquieting aspect to it. I think it's predicated on the uniformity of taste and aims of these mega institutions and events that reach all the way from the extreme east to the westernmost corner of the globe, say from Beijing to Dublin. Now, what may appear to be inclusive may actually be the continued hold of the Western modernist canon, which tends to undermine local voices and practices, thereby destroying the polyphony of expressions. And I've written about it before, and we had an interesting exchange about it. Now, these developments force us to ask, in what ways can we study cultural encounters? And can this ever be a neutral exercise? So I want to foreground the theoretical underpinnings of cultural interfaces and offer some pointers to further explorations of the relationship between European and Asian cultures in general. I mean, this also includes Africa and other countries, but just to take these two entities. What's been called a period of tumultuous relationship, this was actually conference a little while ago, between Europe and, actually it was America, but anyway, Europe and Asia falls roughly between the late 18th century and, of course, the present. It lies at the very heart of Western colonial expansion, followed by decolonization. Now, this is an era that's characterized by an unequal power relationship between Europe and the rest of the world. We know it, but traces of which still remain. Now, when considering the East-West transmission of ideas in this period, I think it's tempting to regard the westernization of non-Western countries as the inevitable unfolding of Hegelian logic. One is persuaded to focus on the flow of ideas from Europe to countries like India simply as a single source of the modern. But on the other hand, the West's discovery and use of Asian philosophies and artistic forms is deemed valuable primarily because of a perceived minor role in contributing to Western modernity. Sorry. As the intellectual historian J.J. Clark observes, even in times characterized by the globalization of culture, there still remains an endemic Eurocentrism, a reluctance to accept that the West could ever borrow anything of significance from the East, or to see the place of Eastern thought within the Western tradition as intellectual lightweight, at best only a trivial part of a wider reaction against the modern world. Now, behind this reluctance is the authority of the European knowledge system that is, of course, closely bound up with the prevailing geopolitics. Now, I would say to make the transition from historical determinism to a new way of thinking isn't easy. I think we need to revise afresh our, I might say, mindset, and really see the flow of global culture not solely from the West to the rest. And I usually think of it as a waterfall from coming up from top to this going down all the way, but simply as a multiple crisscrossing of reciprocal ideas that flow in different directions. Now, the superstructure of modern historical scholarship, including art history, rests essentially on Western epistemic foundations. And of course, this scholarship fell prey to the body of representations created through European expansion from the 18th century. Take art history, for instance. It claims Kantian objectivity, which she just now mentioned, in evaluating the finer qualities of works of art, irrespective of their cultural origins. Yet, since the 19th century, the established tradition of scholarship on Asian art has rested on the implied superiority of the Western canon vis-à-vis all other traditions. In 97, long time ago, my work on Marchmalade Monsters, I questioned such optimistic formulation of the universal principles of art. Johann Joachim Winckelmann's dictum on the noble simplicity and quiet grandeur of Greek art, I had argued, had a detrimental effect on art historical discourse, indirectly contributing to the distortion of Indian and other non-Western art in colonial art history. This collective and frequently negative images of non-Western art were shared in other spheres of knowledge. Edward Said had actually coined the term, as you know, we all know, Orientalism, to describe, I quote, the corporate institution for dealing with the Orient, dealing with it by making statements about it, authorizing views of it, describing it, by teaching it, settling it, ruling over it. In short, Orientalism as a Western style of dominating, restructuring, and having authority over the Orient, end quote. Now, the analysis of colonial discourse as a discipline, of course, produced a rich crop of committed scholarship that has made a lasting impact on the academic scene. Post-colonial scholars who unraveled the complex relationship between representation, power, and authority helped set up the ground rules for the new cultural studies. Though by no means the sole approach to the subject, and my own approach is more grounded in history, the importance of post-structuralist, semiotic, and psychoanalytic contributions in these developments can't be gainsaid. Now, while one must acknowledge the ideological component of colonial representations, but I would nevertheless use here the case of America to argue that American encounters with India amounted to something more than an assortment of collective European myths and stereotypes. I won't have time to go into that today. I mean, I've written on it in greater extent. So, this reciprocity which actually marked the passage of ideas in both directions. For example, an engaging intellectual tradition in the US, Transcendentalism, emerged in the 19th century owing directly to the American discovery of ancient Indian thought. It's a really a striking study of how cultures flow across national boundaries. Now, of course, the relationship between US and colonized India was necessarily a symmetrical one, but we still can't dismiss this intellectual discovery on the part of American thinkers simply as a manifestation of colonial discourse of difference. Of course, at the same time, I would caution that viewing cultural flows as a form of global interconnectedness, certainly there is a danger of considering such relationships in anodyne terms. I'm acutely aware that such encounters are uneven and often take place between unequal partners. In addition, just as we have learned that the East is not a monolithic entity, much post-colonial theory, I feel, hasn't really given sufficient recognition to the sheer diversity of Western cultures and responses in their interaction with Asia, for instance. So I will try and highlight the essentially dialectical nature of what I call cultural border crossings. Each culture seeking out those precise elements that resonate with its own preoccupations, with its own cultural imaginary. So if we are to produce more inflected readings of global encounters during the colonial period, what possible approaches can we adopt? First one, Mary Louise Pratt's notion of contact zones, I think, offers us some useful lessons. She defines the contact zone, I quote, as a space of colonial encounters, the space in which people geographically and historically separated come into contact with each other and establish ongoing relations, usually involving conditions of coercion, radical inequality, and intractable conflict, end quote. So Pratt doesn't discount the role of power in such transactions, which is very much part of, she shared with other post-colonial scholars. At the moment, what interests me is an approach that allows for the possibility of a more productive relationship between cultures as a species of encounter, exchange, and negotiation. Let me read out another passage. I quote. She says, "I aim to foreground the interactive dimensions of colonial encounters, so easily ignored or suppressed by diffusionist accounts of conquest and domination." So she looks at co-presence, interaction, interlocking understandings and practices, often within radically asymmetrical relations of power, end quote. Let's not get too far from the topic under discussion. Of course, power has a certain purchase in our study of cross-cultural exchanges. But in some ways, it doesn't quite explain the true nature of this cosmopolitan imaginary. How do ideas cross borders, and what happens to them when they begin their afterlives in other cultures? The second idea I want to float is the notion of cosmopolitanism, which furnishes us with another related working tool. I know, I introduced this with a full knowledge of the dangers of using this term. It's been very controversial. The classical meaning of a cosmopolitan, someone who is able to transcend his or her parochial locus to become a world citizen. Now, within the transcultural framework of globalization, I think this term offers some useful means of understanding modern population movements and cultural intersections. The term cosmopolitanism is meant to counter pessimism about the possibility of fruitful cultural exchanges, amid the morass of power politics. Its, of course, most eloquent champion is the philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah, who injects a much-needed ethical dimension to the globalization debate. Excuse me. Appiah views cosmopolitan values as a thread that ties human beings together, rejecting identity politics and nationalist claims to an exclusive cultural patrimony. I think he makes a persuasive case for everyone's right to share the common human heritage, regardless of race, gender, and orientation, placing his faith in the individual's ability to overcome parochialism and aspire for world citizenship. While his Aristotelian universalism offers as a welcome corrective to perhaps the politics of difference, I'm uncomfortable because it doesn't address power and authority that confer visibility and inclusion in the uneven relation between center and periphery. So Craig Cohen actually mounted a very powerful critique, I quote, of the extreme and abstract view of cosmopolitanism as an autonomous entity. Not only does such cosmopolitanism camouflage privilege, it fails to appreciate the importance of solidarity, especially for those who lack power. A more limited and political cosmopolitanism that accommodates difference and hybridity may make a more effective engine of global change. Now, taking cosmopolitanism as a working hypothesis, I'd like to extend its scope in the global circulation of information. Now, I want to take Mary Louise Pratt's concept a little further. Now, in fact, a novel social space opened up in the wake of widespread spread of print capitalism during the colonial era, which introduced ideas of enlightenment to regions outside Europe. Now, Benedict Anderson talks about print culture and imagined communities. In my recent book, Triumph of Modernism, I try to extend Anderson's concept of the imagined community to the global level. See, during this period of colonialism, transmission of knowledge between center and periphery took place through an imagined community that might be described as a virtual cosmopolis. So what happened was, I call this virtual cosmopolitan, who engages with printed texts emanating from the center and yet be able to generate new forms of knowledge. Now, these exchanges are not necessarily dependent upon direct power relations, but of course, there is that uneven relationship between center and periphery. Now, so this actually also gives recognition to coexistence and mutual influence of multiple centers within this informal global network. So I'm going to go through a bit more quickly. So while I was working on this paper, I found that these exchanges are not one-directional. Now, what I found is that less explored is the impact of ancient Indian thought on American intellectuals. In fact, the dynamics of circulation of ideas from inside one's own culture and its creative uses were no different among American intellectuals than the Indian intelligentsia. In fact, Asian classical philosophy translated into French and English, and their diffusion through print technology gave Western intellectuals an entry point into the thoughts of complex cultures of Asia. So what I see is that American and Indian intellectuals were operating in a virtual space that generated a mode of conversation across cultures, leading to the production of new ideas. So how can we look at this new, this form of cultural exchange that's not prejudged by a dependency syndrome So my final point, Mikhail Bakhtin coins the term, as we know, dialogic, to describe a continuous dialogue with other works of literature. This process appropriates words of others and transforms them according to one's own creative intentions. This intertextual process is dynamic, relational, and they engage in endless redescriptions of one's own world vision. Now, this could be a very useful tool for us for our cross-cultural analysis of visual art. Its merit is that it allows for coexistence of ideas and approaches in a relativist way, doesn't set up an essentialist hierarchy of ideas and values, as in the case of colonial discourse. So this accords well with the hybrid and multifaceted cosmopolitanism, in the sense that the foreign texts received by the recipient, interpreted in the light of one's own text, sets up a dialogic relationship between the global and the vernacular within a cosmopolitan framework. So I better stop here because I think the time is nearly up, right? So, okay, thanks. I think we can take it.